Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. I was going to have you sing a song while I took my last few sips of this Caribou Daybreak coffee. Boy, is that outstanding. Have you tasted it? Yeah, you have. It is really great. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and this Jumble Justice Radio Show. I was going to mention to Johnny Cash when he stops in Dayton within the next year, so be careful. I'll have more to say about this in our news segment, but Dayton is the place where our Attorney General and the Justice Department has told Dayton, Ohio Police Department, can you imagine this, that they must accept people who get F on the police entrance exam. How in the world would we ever want a cop to be able to, you know, read, write, and pass an entrance exam to be a police officer? Yeah, they didn't have enough minorities that passed, so they changed the scoring, and that moved up, I think, like 258 people. And I understand that they've actually done that, I believe it was New Orleans and Louisiana also. But can you believe that? The head of the NAACP, I guess I won't have to talk about it in the news segment, the head of the NAACP in Dayton says this is outrageous. I mean, he said that, you know, you're putting people on the police department that can't even pass the test to get on. And I'm sure that Dayton, like most of these other cities of any size whatsoever, spent a lot of time working on the validity and reliability of that exam. But anyway, thank you, Johnny. Be careful in Dayton the next year, so who knows. But anyway, Audrey, thank you for getting us on the show and taking care of all these preset things. You know, Blog Talk Radio is doing something here. They got a message. They're currently updating their listener reporting. And it's got a little flashing sign and all that, so I hope it doesn't mess up our broadcast and disappoint our six or seven listeners worldwide. I'm kidding. Emily and Mike, thank you very much for joining us, too. The purpose of this show is what it's always been. We like to look at news and issues and events and developments, some strange, and the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. We dedicate this show to these energetic police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals, and met some interesting folks this week in that business who protect us throughout the United States and around the world. Try to look at criminal justice up close and take a close-up look at its practicing professionals. You're listening on Blog Talk Radio. It just keeps getting fuller and fuller in terms of program choices. I mean, you could spend the next 14 centuries listening to all of the shows that are on Blog Talk Radio. We're not one of those featured ones because I haven't chosen to do that, but I could, you know, how would you like that? Mike and Emily and Audrey, we could put your face up on the screen. It would show up all the time, like on those feature channels. I don't want that either. A little different here, but we want to thank Alan Levy, the CEO of PTR, for getting this thing started. We're 4.5 years in the making now in terms of this this show. But you can't have your own show, so if you want to do that, it's any interest group, any person, any kind of organization. Well, I'm not sure any kind, but you don't want a hate group with their own radio show. I'm sure they would be blocked out, but you can have your show on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and it's absolutely free if you want to broadcast before 7 p.m. or after 11 p.m. Any show that's in the 7-11 now, there's actually a little monthly fee. Not debilitating, but it is no longer free. These shows are archived immediately. They show up on MP3 format, and they're on podcastdirectory.com in order of the show. So if you went to podcastdirectory.com, type in this Jumble Justice, our most recent show would be on there. So get your own show if you don't like this one. Some people actually actually do that. Let's take a look at some of the news for this evening. There's certainly some interesting stuff to look at. And I thought this was an interesting one. If you got time for me to, bring it up here. But we're stopping executions in the United States. I might have even mentioned this two weeks ago. There was just a little story about it, but it's become even more complex. We have the Drug Enforcement Administration involved in this case. The worldwide shortage of drugs used in executions, if you can believe that, reverberated this week in Texas announced it would replace the anesthetic in its three-drug regimen, and federal agents selected seized Georgia's supply. What? The seizure on Tuesday of the powerful barbiturate sodium thiopental at the Georgia Diagnostic and Classification Prison in the site of the state's death row has at least temporarily blocked future executions, although none are now scheduled. In Texas, where the administrative change was announced Wednesday, lawyers for an inmate scheduled to die next month, he challenged this new drug. The move in both states continues the fallout from the January announcement from Hospira Incorporated, the only American producer of sodium thiopental. They stopped making it. So they've been getting some, I guess, from another nation, but many of the 34 states with the death penalty, Illinois just got rid of theirs, remember that, have been scrambling for months to find stores of sodium thiopental to replace it with other drugs that have similar effects. I'm going to go into detail of this, but there's a three-drug cocktail. You give them one, you give them a second one, and then you give them a third one, and that stops the heart. It says, like in most states, lethal injection protocols, sodium thiopental was first used to anesthetize the inmate, and then other drugs are administered to actually paralyze the body and then stop the heart. But the DEA seized this drug in the Georgia Department of Corrections. They said they're cooperating because they think they're getting it from an unlawful site like overseas or something like that. A lawyer who represents this inmate, a murderer scheduled to die on Texas on April 5, said she would challenge the timing and process for making this change. We believe under state law that they're required to have some sort of vetting process for the drug. How do you vet a drug that kills people? Anybody want to volunteer to check out that drug? But isn't that the Danish company that makes pentobarbital has informed states that it is adamantly opposed to the use of its product in execution. So I guess somebody's trying to sneak that in, or at least use that. All this argument about executions and the drugs and whether it's a one drug, Ohio broke. Made news here recently, their last execution, they just used one great big drug, like you do when you have your pet put asleep. But now most of them are still dealing with the three drug cocktail thing, and really, really sort of odd. I mean, I seriously don't get it. Okay, let's take a look at another news story. I thought this was interesting. I'll get this one out of the way real quick. But there's a cop from Chicago who should be punished, and he was charged with lying about the torture of homicide suspects and he's reported to a federal prison in North Carolina. John Burge, commander of the infamous Midnight Crew in the 1970s and 80s, was sentenced in January to 4.5 years after being, hold on just a second, convicted of, I'll bet you couldn't guess. They didn't get him for torturing a suspect. They didn't get him for stealing money. They didn't get him for anything. Keep in mind, somebody that does these awful things in the interrogation process, something ought to happen to him, but that ain't what they got him for. He was got by the federal agents. I'll bet you could never guess, Mike. You did. You held up two fingers. He was convicted of perjury, in other words, lying to a federal agent. And what's the second one? Obstruction of justice. So all these other things that he supposedly did, he was never convicted of, not even in Illinois. But now he's doing, what did I say, 5 years? Four and a half years. He won't do all that time probably. But he had already retired, I think, in Florida. I saw that in another article, but really, really weird. There's a nice little thing. You got a bunch of college students have actually started a website. It's two anti-gun advocacy groups. They started a new website called Armed Campuses that lists the colleges and universities where people can carry loaded firearms. The group, one of them is called the Campaign to Keep Guns Off Campus, and the other is the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Say the site will be a resource for parents and students deciding where to go to college. It lists 25 colleges in four states, Colorado, Michigan, Utah, and Virginia. I can't believe my alma mater up there, Michigan State, allows you to carry them on campus and on, but not in buildings. I didn't know that because Michigan is really kind of stringent. That's, Michigan, you can't even have a taser. A taser is a felony in Michigan. Ohio has no rules or regulations about it. And they may soon have more to post, as a number of state legislatures are considering bills to allow firearms on campuses where they are not now banned. But I guess if you got nothing else to do between your Twitters and your tweets, you can come up with a website like this and try to discourage people from being a gun-toting student, they say, here in the article. They want to draw attention to these colleges where students will see that they can carry guns there and they won't go to that. They'll go to another college. The writer is saying, it may have the opposite effect. Students, in fact, may think they might be safer by going to one of these campuses. So kind of an interesting thing. Oh, I love this one. tie me down to the chair, will you? I'm not even going to talk much about it. But here's what's happened. The United States, let me try something. Yes, the United States is now using drones, flying airplane-type drones, to fight the Mexican drug trade. They're stepping up their involvement in Mexico's drug war. The Obama administration has begun sending drones into Mexican territory, that means across the border, to gather intelligence that helps locate major traffickers and follow their networks, according to American and Mexican officials. These are high-flying altitude, unarmed drones. Let me see. Maybe we could stop illegal immigration by... You want to use unarmed ones or armed ones? But we're not using these kind of things to seal the border, because I know some drugs come across the border, but we're going to help Mexico fight their drug trade. Isn't that insane? Incredible. I wonder if they've figured out there might be a little bit of connection between Mexico's drug trade and the illegal immigration stuff occurring at the border, the southwest border. Ah, that could be, I would think so. Well, this is another interesting story I like. Remember Mr. Julian Assange, the founder of the whistleblower website WikiLeaks? He's now warned that the Internet is the greatest spying machine the world has ever seen, and it's an obstacle to free speech. He's speaking to students in Great Britain at Cambridge last Tuesday, and he's, as a former computer hacker, claimed that the Internet, particularly social networking sites such as Facebook, gave governments greater scope for snooping. No kidding. He talks about there was actually a Facebook revolution in Cairo 3 or 4 years ago. He explains. He said it was very small. After that, Facebook was used to round up all the principal participants. They were then beaten, interrogated, and incarcerated. But you know what he's talking about. These people put their life up on Facebook and MySpace. Is MySpace still around? I guess it is. But they throw in all that stuff. And remember Google. They're one of those 1,900 organizations that consult with our national intelligence services to help fight counterterrorism. Remember what Mr. Google said? He knows what you're thinking before you think it. And if you're not using Chrome browser, which I'm using right now, thank you, Mr. Google, all you have to do is type one letter or two, and it goes right to where you're planning on going. He's saying be careful about that. And actually, some police departments are doing the same thing. They're saying, look, if you're going to join a police department, I don't think you want to store a lot of your life up on Facebook, because a lot of people put other stuff up there about you that isn't true. And the cops have to sort of sort through that. They use Facebook to, do part of their background, their extensive background investigation on police advocates. Oh, I like this next one, Mike, and you do too. You're standing up and cheering. Where did you hear the solution to the Somali pirates? Didn't I say that 2 years ago on this show? But we now have one of the most successful operations ever against Somalian pirates. It was escalated against these pirates, and it was accomplished by the Indian Navy. They were arrested after an Indian naval ship closed in on a hijacked fishing vessel just under 700 miles off of the Kerala coastal port of Cochin, something like that. The boat was carrying 61 suspected pirates and 13 of the boat's crew who had been held captive. The suspected pirates had hijacked the boat, the Mozambique-flagged Vega 5, in December last year, and had used it as a base of operation to attack other ships. And it's just terrible what the Indians did. They actually shot at this. They found 80 to 90 small arm rifles and all that business, but they were forced to jump overboard when their own vessel was set ablaze. It caught fire in fierce retaliatory gunfire from the Indian naval vessel. Can you imagine that someone thought that maybe we could put the boat on fire, and the pirates would have to jump in the water, and they could capture all of them? Amazing. I always thought flamethrowers would be the answer to that, but maybe that's what the Indian Navy did. But maybe we could bring the Indian Navy over and talk to some of our flagships, and we can learn how to stop the Somali pirates. It's actually one of the stupidest things I've ever heard of. Okay, how about this one? This is an interesting one here. It says that in New Jersey, you actually got a bill in the legislature that if you're a young person and you're caught sexting, remember what that is? You're using your cell phone to send naked pictures. If you're doing that, you're not going to be prosecuted the first time, although that violates laws in the state of New Jersey, of course, as it does in every state. But you're going to be sent to a diversionary program so that you won't have a criminal record, as a sex offender or misdemeanor, or I don't know if that's a felony maybe, in that particular state. But you're going to go through a diversion and counseling type of program. Maybe not a bad idea. You know, younger people do some really stupid things when it comes to that sort of stuff. But I thought that was interesting. Well, Audrey, I think you've got something for us tonight, don't you? How about a blonde joke? Could we possibly pull that out? Let's see what you've got to say on that blonde joke, if I can get the thing up there. There we go. All right. What do you got, Audrey?
Professor Haley. The blonde joke for tonight has the poor girl struggling with another car problem. I hope folks will enjoy it. Here it is. A blonde was driving down the highway in her aging automobile, when suddenly her left rear tire went flat. After she pulled over to the curb, she got out the car's manual, and read a few lines, and then jumped out of the car, to work on the problem. Another motorist was driving by and saw her outside her car poking holes in the other three tires with an ice pick. The motorist stopped quickly and exited his car to ask her what she was doing. She told him that she had just read in her automobile manual to be sure that all of the four tires had the same tire pressure, meaning they all had the same amount of air in them. She explained that since she did not have a spare tire, or a tire pump, she thought the best thing to do was flatten all of the tires, so the air pressure would be the same in each tire just as the manual required. The motorist got back in his car and said out loud, "Here is one more example of blonde logic."
Okay, what do you think, Emily? Does that end my career of writing blonde jokes? 2 weeks in a row, I've created a blonde joke, and that was my second attempt. I don't think it's going to be a big selling book, so maybe I should stop it. Ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note, let's play the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms, a warning message to the criminals to turn their firearms in.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Okay, we'll go quick now to our green tip because we have an interesting show tonight. As most people know, zip about the Supreme Court and the justices that serve on that, because the court does sort of keep themselves separate and quiet. But we're going to have Professor Noah Feldman talk about four justices that were appointed by President Roosevelt, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and he appointed them thinking that they were going to be kind of liberal, and he talks about how these guys changed when they got assigned to the court. He's talking about Frankfurter, Hugo Black, Robert Jackson, and William Douglas. I know more about three of those. I don't know much about Jackson. But I think you'll find this very interesting. He has really studied these characters. So here's our green tip for tonight from our little book, Esma Floyd's 1001 Ways to Save the Planet. And the tip tonight is to turn off the TV if you have kids and push them out the door and make them do something outside. What an idea. I guess they could Twitter outside, right? And text message outside. Yeah, that'd be okay. But anyway, limit TV time and save electricity and send them outdoors where they can learn to do something besides watch television and play on the computer and their cell phone. I wonder if TV time's actually down for kids. Probably is, isn't it? They're all using their iPhone and biphone and whatever, but anyway, that's kind of an interesting idea. So I think we're going to go straight to the discussion of our Supreme Court justices tonight. This is a podcast on booktv.org. Remember, when you go to booktv.org, most of them are videos where you can actually see the author present for about an hour, but they also have some in their after show type of thing where it's just a podcast and audio. And this is one of those. You can download those. You can download the whole thing. It's about 40 megabytes. I was going to try to upload it to the site. But we're going to do it the old-fashioned way tonight by broadcasting into the phone, and I hope it works. So here we go. It's Professor Neil Feldman, and he's discussing his book, Scorpions, The Battles and Triumphs of FDR's Great Supreme Court Justices. So hold on a second. Here we go.
Coming up next. Book TV presents Afterwards, an hour-long program where we invite guest hosts to interview authors. This week, Harvard Law professor Noah Feldman presents the lives and careers of four Franklin Roosevelt Supreme Court appointees, Felix Frankfurter, Hugo Black, Robert Jackson, and William Douglas. The New York Times Magazine writer focuses on these friends-turned-adversaries as the FDR justices with the most lasting influence on constitutional law. Mr. Feldman discusses their contribution to the modern Constitution with Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and legal correspondent for the online magazine Slate.
Welcome to Book TV's Afterwards. I'm Dahlia Lithwick from Slate.com, and we're here with Noah Feldman to talk about his book, Scorpions. Welcome, Noah.
Thank you.
The premise of this book is that there were four great justices that were appointed by FDR, and I want to start with a definitional question, which is, what's a great justice? FDR put 9 justices on the court, but this book is about 4, so tell me what makes them super justices as opposed to the others.
These are great people, great men, and also great justices. And what makes them great justices is that they had a lasting major impact on the Constitution as we know it. They wrote hugely important decisions, but they did more than that. They defined four new ways of thinking about the Constitution that today really dominate the field of constitutional thought. So if you ask the justices today, you know, what is your constitutional philosophy, they may think, oh, it's my philosophy, but actually they're expressing a philosophy first stated by one of those four men. They were also great men in the good old-fashioned sense of the term, that they had huge personalities, that they were deeply ambitious, that they participated in world events and world affairs, not just on the Supreme Court, but before they went on the Supreme Court, and in some cases, taking little leaves of absence even when they were on the Supreme Court. So in that sense, they mattered. They were people who, they were household names, and their impact on history is meaningful.
And can you, just in the interest of setting the table, tell us who the four are, and just quickly tell us why they were critically important to the way we think about the court today?
Absolutely. I start with Felix Frankfurter, who was, when he went on the Supreme Court, the best-known liberal lawyer in the country. He was a law professor, and he was famous for defending Sacco and Vanzetti, who were two Italian anarchists who were accused, convicted, and executed for murder, robbery that took place in South Braintree, Massachusetts. And whether they did that or not, they were definitely closely connected to a huge national terror network that actually has a lot of parallels to Al-Qaeda and was very active in the United States, and he defended them. So he was famous for that, and that was obviously a very liberal thing for him to do. On the Supreme Court, he was transformed into a judicial conservative. And the reason was that he believed in the ideal of judicial restraint. When he started coming up with this idea, the Supreme Court was a conservative Supreme Court, blocking liberal legislatures from doing what they wanted. And so Frankfurter said, well, then we should back away. The court should have no role. And when he went on the Supreme Court, he continued to believe that. And that's what makes him a great justice, that he remained neutral and ended up as a conservative. The next is Robert Jackson, who is mostly famous for having taken a leave of absence from the Supreme Court to go to Nuremberg, where he was the chief prosecutor in the famous Nazi war crimes trial. Before that, though, he was Solicitor General of the United States, arguing the Supreme Court's cases, U.S. government cases in front of the Supreme Court. He was Attorney General of the United States during the very run-up to World War II, when Roosevelt needed a lot of legal advice on how to maintain U.S. neutrality while at the same time helping Britain. So he played a huge historical role there. And on the Supreme Court, he was amazingly practical. He really seemed to believe that it didn't matter what the law said and it didn't matter what the Constitution said. The Supreme Court's job was to make things work. And he said so very, very explicitly. And again, there are lots of justices who think that way today, but they're not always so honest about it. Third is Hugo Black, a remarkable person from Alabama, got himself elected to the United States Senate by joining the Ku Klux Klan, which gave him a statewide organization at a time when he didn't have any statewide organization. At that time, the Klan was incredibly powerful in Alabama politics. So he was a very radical left-wing senator. He thought we should solve the Great Depression with a 30-hour work week. And when he went onto the Supreme Court, he was woefully unprepared, and he knew it. But he read the classics, he did research on his own, and he came to believe that he had actually a true way of understanding the Constitution according to its original meaning. So he created the idea that we're familiar with today, that the only really fair and just way to read the Constitution is in accordance with what the founding fathers themselves said. And he really came up with this idea, and then he did the research to teach himself how to do it. And amazingly, that made him a liberal justice for the first part of his career, although at the end of his career, he became a conservative. And most remarkably, it led him to take the view that the Supreme Court in the Brown against Board of Education case should strike down segregation as a violation of the original meaning of the 14th Amendment. And that was a way of sort of saving his honor from having been a Klan member. And last but not least, William O. Douglas was a self-made man from real poverty in Washington State who became a law professor and then was noticed by Joe Kennedy Sr., who was the first chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. He brought Douglas to be a minor staffer on the commission, and a year and a half later, he was the chairman of the commission. He brought Douglas to meet Roosevelt. Douglas became a regular player in Roosevelt's poker game, which is a huge part of Roosevelt's inner circle. And Roosevelt said, this is an interesting thing. That young man played an interesting game of poker. And he put him on the Supreme Court when he was 40 years old. And on the court, for the first 10 years, he just wanted to be president of the United States and did everything he could to become president. After that, he developed a judicial philosophy, and that was the philosophy of individual liberty as the highest value of the Constitution. Interestingly, he developed that philosophy at a time when his own inner life was kind of a mess. But it had a constitutional value, even though his own life was messy. He was able to articulate a vision according to which a contribution to let all of us mess up our own lives if we want to.
One thing that's so stunning about your four great justices is they all follow a really kind of hardscrabble, self-made path. They don't look to be sort of classic. You know, they some of them went to great law school, some of them went to no law school at all. Many of them grew up in either middle class or poverty. One was an immigrant. And it's such an interesting contrast to FDR himself, who had this absolutely entitled patrician upbringing, you described it, gentleman senior at Harvard. So I guess I wonder, what does it say that these men who were effectively self-made, very ambitious, as you said, very driven, but what does that say both about FDR and about the time that these were the men that he sort of hand-picked, and he was very involved in moving them? What does that say?
You know, Roosevelt was called by his contemporaries a traitor to his class. And people usually think that what is meant by that is just the idea that he wanted to restrict Wall Street when lots of his classmates were on Wall Street, that he wanted to raise taxes when lots of his contemporaries were rich. And that's all true, but there's more to it than that. It's also that Roosevelt was most comfortable not with the people from boarding schools and fancy colleges that he grew up with, but actually with people who were more colorful, more interesting, and frankly, very often were completely self-made. And he was, of course, the opposite of being self-made. He was probably the most elite young person in America. You know, his cousin had become president of the United States. He had married Eleanor, who was Teddy Roosevelt's favorite niece. He'd gone to all the right schools, never had to work a day in his life. Now, why did Roosevelt choose these particular people? It has a lot to do with the fact that during the Depression, all four of these people stood up and actively took on Wall Street. And that was something that really impressed the heck out of Roosevelt, and it helped him to notice all of them. So Felix Frankfurter, over a long weekend, wrote the first Securities and Exchange Act that helped to create the modern regulatory system of Wall Street as we know it. Hugo Black, as part of his incredibly ambitious Senate career, subpoenaed the telegrams, which are sort of like the emails of the day, of everyone who had sent any telegram to Washington, D.C. for a several-week period, in the hopes of finding embarrassing material about corporate executives, which he did, and then he used that corporate material on the floor of the Senate. So he really had gotten quite nationally famous by saying that Wall Street and big business were really corrupt. Jackson went head-to-head with Andrew Mellon, who was the Secretary of the Treasury and one of the richest men in the country, in a tax fraud trial, which had the unintended result of creating the National Gallery in Washington. But, of course, it also made Jackson famous because Mellon was the establishment. He embodied the financial system of the United States. And last but not least, Douglas, when he was chairman of the SEC, just gleefully took on everybody that he could. He threatened to take over the New York Stock Exchange and run it himself. They were sufficiently scared that they reformed themselves. And he would go around gathering big groups of rich people and giving them speeches called things like the cockroaches of Wall Street. And all of these people got Roosevelt's attention in this way, and they convinced him that they were on the right side of big events.
Which is a nice segue to the next question I wanted to pose. You, I think, make a good point time and again about the extent to which one's biography does inform one's political philosophy. And I think that's always hard to read as somebody who cares about the court, because you want to believe that justices are brains and vats, and that their biographies make no difference because they don the black robes and their biography falls away. Can you give us a few examples? You don't necessarily have to give us a lot, but just examples of ways in which some of your four great justices really were influenced throughout their lives by either the way they grew up or their conflict with Wall Street or whatever it is, but some way in which this really did shape not just their conduct before they got on the court, but their conduct in the judicial worldview after.
Yeah. Let me start with maybe the most shocking example, which is William O. Douglas, whom I mentioned a moment ago. His personal life was unstable from childhood, really. His father died when he was very, very young, and he was very, very poor. He was constantly working multiple jobs. He worked his way through school just to eat. He would sweep the floor in a hash house. And when he got onto the Supreme Court, he was still poor, and he was still personally a little bit unstable. And one of the things that he liked to do was to run around with the Kennedys, Joe Kennedy, and do the things that Joe Kennedy liked to do.
And you can imagine what those things often were. And it sort of led him to the point where his personal equilibrium was really disturbed. At the time, no Supreme Court justice had ever been divorced. And Douglas became the first justice to get divorced, then the second, then the third. And he did remarry a fourth time, though by all accounts he wasn't very faithful even to his fourth wife. And during all of this, he gradually, first of all, came to the fact he would never be president. One divorce was enough to do that in this period. But also, he came to ask himself, what is my philosophy of life? And you might say he developed this philosophy of life at the same time that he was melting down. And he came up with the idea that his philosophy was a very Western state philosophy of take a gamble, go out on your own, be a solitary horseman riding into the sunset. And then he thought, what does this have to do with the Constitution? And he had an answer. And his answer was that our Constitution protects our individual right to marry whom we wish, sleep with whom we wish, speak to whom we wish, associate with whom we wish, and really define ourselves in terms of our liberty and our basic freedom. And so he became the key figure in writing opinions that eventually led to the right to contraception, eventually the right to abortion. And, you know, when the Supreme Court has decided gay rights questions, again, Douglas's views have been quoted. And when the Supreme Court deals with the gay marriage question, which eventually it will, again, these values that he brought to the table are going to be discussed. So it's not a story necessarily of an inspirational background leading him to a constitutional philosophy, but it is a story of how personality just matters enormously in the shaping of ideals.
I wonder if, as we're talking about how these justices, their ideals were forged, I wonder how much it matters, I'm guessing you're going to say a lot, that they came to be both public individuals in various government capacities and then later on the court, at a time when the court was dominated by these so-called nine old men, by these grumpy old guys that FDR had essentially written off. How much of each of them was influenced, how much of their jurisprudence was influenced by the sort of Lochner-era pro-corporate view of the court that FDR really, I think, was at war with?
It mattered a lot at first. It mattered a lot when they first started on the court, because then, in their very first years, they were with Roosevelt, and their overarching goal was to stop the Supreme Court from blocking the legislature from regulating business. But when they realized that they were a majority on the court, they discovered that they didn't have to restrict themselves to judicial restraint, to holding back. They realized they could also do things affirmatively. And there was a crucial moment when they realized this. And it happened in a case involving the Pledge of Allegiance. There were Jehovah's Witnesses kids in schools who did not want to salute the flag and recite the Pledge of Allegiance. And the reason they didn't want to do that is they truly believed sincerely that this was an act of idolatry, that to pledge allegiance to the flag and to salute it was similar to worshiping the flag, and that was against their religious faith. That was very unpopular, of course, in wartime America. And the first time the issue came before the Supreme Court, Roosevelt's justices mostly said that the witnesses were not entitled to an exception from the rule, that if they didn't salute the flag, they could be suspended. Then after the Supreme Court held that, there was violence against witnesses all over the country, kind of minor pogroms with witnesses killed in some cases, injured in others, with witnesses' meeting halls actually burned to the ground, and they realized that they had made a terrible mistake. Felix Frankfurter, who had written the opinion the first time, refused to change his view. He said, this sort of thing was right when we were citing the nine old men. It's right now, and it's going to continue to be right in the future. The other liberal justices said, no way. We are the Supreme Court. We're going to protect minorities. And Justice Jackson, Robert Jackson, who had just come on the court at this point, wrote a very beautiful opinion where he said that the government can't tell you what's orthodox. And the job of the Supreme Court is to take certain things away from the government. And one of them is the ability to force people to salute. Very inspiring opinion. But it was not judicial restraint. It was judicial activism. And once that happened, the other justices really moved away from the focus on allowing the legislature to regulate corporations. They still voted that way, mind you. But it was no longer their really primary motive. And then the punchline to that is actually kind of an interesting one. In 1951, when the Korean War was going very badly, President Harry Truman thought he should do something about this. And ultimately, he decided, in 1952 actually, to seize the U.S. steel mill from the corporations that owned them to resolve a labor dispute in favor of the union. This is a pro-union thing that Truman did. And the Roosevelt justices, all four of them, voted to strike this down, saying that he lacked the authority to do this. And although it was a case about the separation of powers and presidential power, not so much a case about corporate power, the truth is he was still doing it on behalf of the union. And by now, none of them were on the side of the union. They saw this as a constitutional issue, and it shows you how things had changed, really, from the Depression, when the main question was government regulating corporations, to the post-World War II period, where suddenly the issues look different.
So, and it also, I think, shows how this definition of activism has always been so slippery and so, you know, that everybody has used that label. It's an entirely ends-driven label, and that every court at some level is activist just by virtue of the fact that they do something.
I agree with that. And what's more, I would say that activism is what you get when you have 5 votes on the Supreme Court and a legislature that's doing something different. And, you know, historically, neither liberals nor conservatives have any monopoly on either criticizing the other side as activists or as being activists. What you want to do is you want to look and see who's in charge of Congress and who has 5 votes on the court. And when those don't match, you find that many, many, many Supreme Court justices are prepared, in fact, almost all are prepared to vote to strike down legislation. And I should say, we shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that in their hearts, they believe themselves to be political in this way. I think they often don't. I think the justices actually imagine themselves, both then and now, in many cases, to actually be just simply following the Constitution. But if you look outside of their inner beliefs and what they're actually doing, it is amazing how frequently 5 votes will get you activated.
I want you to contrast for me, because it's one of the very striking parts of your book. And we're talking to Neil Feldman, the author of Scorpions. FDR's deep involvement with each of these 4 justices, for years before in some cases, I think it's really striking when you compare it to other presidents, some of whom met their nominees, you know, the day before, some of them have been vetted by third parties. It seems to me that each of these men in different ways were quite intimate, and from the poker games on death, quite intimately involved with Roosevelt. And in fact, you know, Stuart Frankfurter seems to have been kind of manipulating, I don't know if manipulating is the word you want to use, but certainly really pulling a lot of strings for years before. And I wonder if that's a good thing or a bad thing, Noah, to have such a deep, deep relationship. And a political relationship. In some cases, I guess, Jackson had a more sort of lawyerly relationship with the president. But some of these people were political advisors, not just before they got on the bench, but even after. Can you talk about, is that something that seems like it's something that's changed? I wonder if it's a change for the better.
It's changed completely, and it's changed on both ends. First of all, you have presidents who are interviewing potential Supreme Court justices, like a job interview. It can form some impression in an hour of the person. But Roosevelt nominated people whom he knew intimately and had known for years. And the knowledge of those people meant that he knew what he was getting. He knew he was getting justices who used correspondence of his, but he also knew what kind of people they were. And he didn't just want people who would vote his way. He wanted people who would do interesting and important things on the Supreme Court, and he got that. The other way in which it's really, really changed is, as you say, that Roosevelt's justices did not stop talking to him when they went on the Supreme Court. They didn't stop playing poker. They didn't stop giving political advice. They didn't stop writing regular letters back and forth. Felix Frankfurter, who loved to send people for jobs to Roosevelt, he usually waited for Roosevelt to ask, but not always, kept on doing that when he was on the Supreme Court. In fact, when Roosevelt needed someone who was going to be called the assistant president for war mobilization, that was the unofficial title, but this is really the most important person other than the president of the country, Frankfurter said, well, there's a justice here, Jimmy Burns. He would be great for the job. Why don't you take him? And sure enough, Roosevelt did hire Supreme Court justice to do that. And that's completely changed. Today, even the annual dinner that used to take place where the justices go to the White House has been canceled as, you know, perceived as in some way a violation of the separation of powers. So we expect the justices today to be almost like monks. We expect them to be cut off from the world of Washington and the world of the politics, and certainly to be cut off from the president. You'll remember a couple of years back when Dick Cheney and Justice Anthony Scalia were on a duck hunting trip together, Justice Scalia was heavily criticized for sitting on an opinion that involved the vice president, and he actually wrote a separate opinion of his own explaining that they weren't even in the same duck blind. And again, this would have been just unimaginable back in this period. I actually think we've lost something significant here, because the Supreme Court is a political body as well as a judicial body. That's just a reality about it. And I think if you're going to do some politics, you'll do it better if you have a better understanding of how the Supreme Court fits in to the bigger political world of Washington. I mean, a great example of this is when the Supreme Court, sometime back now, in the beginning of the Paula Jones-Bill Clinton litigation, held that it was not going to be very inconvenient for the president or distract him at all if a lawsuit against him, a civil lawsuit by Paula Jones, continued during his presidency. Now, if the Supreme Court had said, this is a matter of principle, I don't care if you're the president, you know, the law doesn't go forward, that would have been one thing. But that's not what they said. They said, well, you know, her rights are important, she should have her lawsuit, but we're not that worried about it distracting the president. And that was just naive. And I think that in today's world, you could actually imagine justices who understand the presidency so little that they would think that a lawsuit wouldn't occupy the president's time. That was not the case then. You wouldn't have had an outcome like that. So the extent that the Supreme Court is making practical decisions, I think there's some loss. That said, there is a big gain, and the gain is in the appearance of objectivity. You know, we do think of these justices and their black robes as sort of priests. I personally think we shouldn't think of them that way, but we do think of them that way to some extent, and that does make them seem more objective, and maybe it increases how legitimate they are, too.
Well, so that's a beautiful lead into my next question, which is, some of these justices were very badly behaved, Noah. Hugo Black was in the KKK. He refused to recuse himself in a thing that looks a lot like Duckgate that you just referred to with this 16. And it seems as though, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but some of that behavior was called out by the other justices, by the media. It seems as if the world was a lot leakier at that time, and folks were giving interviews to reporters. And I wonder if you could reflect on, was it just a matter of these were guys who made bad decisions, you know, Robert Jackson sending off appalling messages from Nuremberg? Were they making bad choices, or were they getting caught making bad choices? That our justices, as you said, I think, you know, there's never a scandal anymore. There's never bad behavior. No one calls anyone out. And in fact, when President Obama called out the court last year in the State of the Union, it was, you know, shocking. So I think one of the things I guess I'm trying to get at is that it was all out there at the time. Now, whatever intramural unhappiness is happening, it still seems to stay intramural.
So I should say first that one of the reasons I had so much fun writing this book, and it's one of the reasons I decided to write it, was this huge contrast between the Supreme Court justices today, who are, as you say, very well-behaved, polite, smart people, and the justices of 70 years ago who were badly behaved, and it was found out that they were badly behaved. It was in the newspapers, and it's taken raised eyebrows and all kinds of shock. I think that part of what was going on in the lives of those justices is that because they were different kinds of people, because they were ambitious people, because they were political people, because they were risk-taking people, they did the things that ambitious, risk-taking people, like politicians, do. And it's probably not a surprise that today's Supreme Court, which is not made up of professional politicians, are careful, cautious, boring lawyers. I mean, I don't mean that in an insulting way, you know, but they would probably be pleased to be boring in that sense. So you don't catch them in political scandal. You don't catch them taking money from a foundation which has, you know, just a single donor, you know, or, you know, you don't, you know, hear rumors of them being caught in the Supreme Court chambers, you know, sleeping with their secretaries, you know. I mean, there's a kind of world that is gone in that respect. So I think partly it's that they did make bad decisions, but making occasionally bad decisions is part of what many truly great people in history do. And you just have to turn on the cable news channels, if you can bring yourself to observe that fact. So one of the things I'm saying in this book is that you get a certain kind of greatness when you have a certain kind of person. And if you prohibit those kind of people from being on the Supreme Court, if you limit, narrow, and constrain your choices of public officials to only the good boys and girls, you get a lot more boring people. And, you know, we sometimes, I think, in many areas, need great men and women, but great men and great women have flaws. And there's a trade-off there. And my view is that we'd do better in terms of the justices of the Supreme Court when they were sometimes badly behaved. And that I will take the bitter with the sweet. You know, I'll take the bad behavior, the arguments, the anger, the mutual hatreds that emerged, and the great ideas that came with it, the ideas of changing the country, of changing the Constitution in meaningful ways, in place of the friendly, pleasant, tea-drinking, nice people whom we have now. And I should say I like them all. I mean, they really are that. They really are nice people.
I wonder how much that's influenced by, again, the difference between the presidential appointments, because it seems to me that Roosevelt was absolutely clear, and he makes this point with reference to the appointment of Hugo Black. He's a political job, and that's why I'm taking someone out of the Senate. He's a political person, and it was right in the wake of the court packing plan, which I think at that point he knew was a defeat for him. And he said, this is part of my little coda to the court passing plan. I'm going to show you how political this institution is by putting a politician on it. I try to map that onto today when we're so careful to say not only is the nominee not political, they've never had a political thought in their lives, and if they have, don't worry, we've heard it. So I think that there is not just the difference in the great man, but in the people nominating the great man, and maybe the conversation that we want to have about greatness that forces us to say, this court is so utterly apolitical. It really is nine grains in that FDR would have laughed at.
Yeah, I think you would have thought it was ridiculous. And you can actually see in the present nominees that there's a kind of schizophrenia. So, you know, President Bush wanted people who had some politics, but he couldn't appoint politicians. So both of the people he appointed were people who had been lawyers in the executive branch, Robert Camilleri. So that's, and then if you look at, Justice Kagan, she also was a lawyer in the executive branch. And when she had any opinions, you used to see her opinions written down on memos that she wrote for the president. When they asked her about this, their confirmation, she said, well, I was working for my boss. I was a lawyer for my boss. These are my bosses. You know, which is partly true, but of course it's not completely the way that opinion writing or memorandum writing really works. And I think that the political nature of the court for Roosevelt was something he couldn't avoid because he lived through it. And the whole public had lived through it. They have had this enormous series of events where the New Deal had been passed and the Supreme Court had struck down the New Deal. So its political nature was unavoidable. We have less of an excuse because we have lived through the Bush against Gore decision, which certainly looked like a highly politicized decision. And yet somehow, instead of emerging from that saying, okay, the court's political, let's live with that fact, we instead emerged by saying, let's pretend even harder that the court isn't political. Let's deeply engage in this kind of, and I don't think it's going too far to say it's organized hypocrisy that we have around the Supreme Court, according to which we insist on their objectivity and lawyerliness, even as we have computer programs that, judging by various factors, can do a reasonably good job of predicting how they're going to vote. Now, I should add, by the way, it's important to distinguish the Supreme Court from other judges, because most lower court judges are nowhere near so political, and their job is not so political. But the Supreme Court only hears cases if they're genuinely uncertain. And I think Roosevelt just that bull by the horn.
And I wonder if you can, if we're in the sort of business now of toggling back and forth between then and now, mull for a minute about the role of the confirmation process, because your great justices had, what, 2 days confirmations, if that, some of them didn't show up.
Most of them didn't have any confirmations at all. So Hugo Black's a great example, nominated on a Wednesday, confirmed on a Monday. He didn't show up, and in fact, no Supreme Court justice ever showed up for a confirmation hearing until Felix Frankfurter. Usually what you would do is, at most, you would send a proxy to stand in for you. It was considered below your dignity as a potential justice to be badgered by a bunch of senators. And frankly, when you watch it on television, I mean, maybe it is below their dignity.
Mm-hmm.
But Frankfurter did go. And the reason he went, and there's some great stories in this, is that a series of red tapers appeared before the Senate and announced, essentially, that Frankfurter must be a constitutional. He was Jewish, he was a liberal, he had defended Sacco and Vanzetti, he was one of the founding advisors of the ACLU, he was one of the founding advisors of the NAACP, so he had to be communist. And, of course, in some cases, he had served on some of these organizations with communists. There were actual communists on the advisory board of the ACLU at the time. And Frankfurter realized he could not just sit in his office and hope this went away. So he went, But what he did is also amazing in its contrast with the way that nominees go today. You know, a senator, Senator McCarran, said to him, "Are you now, sir, or have you ever been a communist?" And instead of just answering the question happily, the way one presumably would today, Frankfurt essentially yelled at him and said, "You know, sir, I would pose my Americanism against yours at any moment. I'm an immigrant to this country. I am, you know, deeply committed to my American values and ideals. How dare you ask me that question?" And the entire chamber burst into applause, as you can see in the Senate records of servants. And he got confirmed.
And got rip-roaring drunk.
And then he went out and got rip-roaringly drunk afterwards. And while drunk, this also shows you how different things were. He went out with Dean Acheson, later Secretary of State, which is proxy there. They got drunk. And then Frankfurter said, "You know what? I think we should go tell Roosevelt the story of what just happened." And Acheson, who was, by the way, of Roosevelt's school, he was in, you know, in a sort of old line, watched or gone to the fanciest schools, said, "I don't think we should just show up drunk at the White House." And Frankfurter said, "No, no, no, we're going to go to the White House." So they drove to the White House. They wander into the White House. They wander into the Secretary's office. And they say, "Oh, we need 50 minutes of the President's time." And the Secretary says, "Okay, fine, 5 minutes." They go in an hour and a half later, they're still regaling the President with details. So it's, you know, a different degree of relaxation. And today, of course, that would be a headline. Supreme Court justice shows up at White House drunk. You know? But then it was just, people were a little bit more forgiving, I think, of the human aspect of their public officials than we are today.
And I wonder if, just to go back to my initial question, part of the problem with the confirmation hearings we have now is there's this utter lack of knowledge about the rest of the confirmation process. And then we sort of slip on and we watch for a couple of days, and as you said, it's quite hypocritical and quite staged, and then we flip it off. Whereas it seems to me what I found very striking, again, I've been covering the court for 10 years, is how deeply involved the public were with the court. So that I think that there's a strange way in which confirmation hearings have become almost a proxy for involvement with the court. I'm thinking of the example I'm thinking of is Hugo Black. It comes out after he's confirmed that he's a KKK member. He gets on the radio and explains himself. And Americans listen and they change their minds. But it's so...
Some do.
But at least the extent to which there was a dialogue between the public and the president and the court about the court then that it seems to have vaporized. And in its place, we have these weird, strange moments, either at the confirmation hearings or that weird State of the Union moment with the president. But it seems that the discourse hasn't improved with the modern media. It seems that it's degraded. Am I right in saying that?
I disagree.
It's kind of an interesting discussion, isn't it, I think, about the dynamics of Supreme Court justices, how they get appointed, what happens to them after they get on the court. And these four gentlemen certainly were men that made a lasting impression upon the court and also on the rule of law that we live under today. Well, thank you very much for listening tonight, and check on the billing and see what we're going to do next week. And we'll sign off with Vera Lynn singing "We'll Meet Again."
We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know